I'm reading from the book of Matthew, chapters 5, verses 13 to 16, from the New Revised Standard Version, subtitled, Salt and Light. It says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled on the foot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. And God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and infallible word."
So you have heard Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, that reminds us that Jesus said to the disciples on the hillside, "You are the salt of the earth. If the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled under feet. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and gives it light, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." I couldn't have chosen a better text for this Sunday morning. I couldn't have thought of a better space for us to be going into the autumn term than this. As we learn and think about and follow Jesus, what does it mean to be his disciples and his followers in the 21st century? What does it mean for you in your workplace, in your home? What does it mean for what you do with your money, for what you do with your time, your priorities, your relationships? The Sermon on the Mount is the greatest message ever preached by the greatest preacher who ever lived, with the strongest truth that you could ever imagine. If we could let this get a hold of us, it would transform our lives. For 30 years, I have wrestled with this text, and I still feel as if I've only scratched the surface of it. I read it every single week of my life. I reflect on it every single week of my life. I ask God to help me to live in the realities of what it presents. And as we go through this series, this autumn, I pray that you will be captivated by the call to be salt and light. That you will understand what it means, that you will follow Jesus into all the places that he wants you to go. Every Sunday, I release a set of cell notes. So many, hundreds of our cell leaders thank me for them regularly. They will be released after the 9 or the 11. I can't remember when they go by email. But they are designed to help you in small groups think about this. Reflect on this. Apply this into your life. Apply it into the decisions that you've got to make each week. Every week. I want us not just to hear a message on a Sunday, but to embed it in our lives on a Monday. Because you all know, don't you, that Monday morning is as holy as Sunday morning. That what you say in the office uses the same language, the same tongue, the same mind, and the same imagination as what you sing on a Sunday. There is not two versions of you. There's one. And God asks you not to live in duplicity, but to make sure that you are living with singleness of heart and mind and purpose and intention, so that you are salt and you are light. In Matthew's gospel, there are three simple but small metaphors that Jesus uses as Matthew records them. And they're all tiny: salt, light, and yeast, which he uses later in the parables, which I will be exploring in our 4 p.m. service, by the way, the Kingdom Parables. The thing about salt and light and yeast is this: you don't need a lot of them to make a big difference. And if you have too much salt, it isn't great. Anybody ever had a really, 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 really salty bowl of soup? Blech. Have you ever been in a situation where somebody has shone a light straight into your face? What happens? You can't see. And if too much yeast is put into your bread, well, I don't mean to be indelicate, but it just gives you wind. And the problem with many believers is we misunderstand the metaphors of salt and light and yeast. First of all, Jesus uses salt and light, which I'm going to focus on today, to help us to understand that we can make a difference wherever we are. We are called to be a difference wherever we are. You notice that Jesus doesn't say, you are salt and light when you worship together. You are salt and light when you gather together. You are salt and light when you come to a service. No, you are salt and light wherever you are. You are a grain of salt. You are a single flame on a clay candle, a clay lamp. Your life can shine into the darkest of places. And you might think, I'm not big enough, or I'm not strong enough, or I'm not bright enough, or I'm not bold enough, but you're misunderstanding the text. The very point that Jesus is making, remember, he is speaking to a group of people who are largely excluded by the Jewish authorities and feel poor and marginalized and unwanted by the religious systems of Israel. He is saying to them, not you will become salt and light. You are salt. You are light. When you walk in relationship with Jesus, he makes you salt. He makes you light. He doesn't say, become salt. He doesn't say, prove that you are salt. He says, you are salt and you are light. And as we consider that for a few moments this morning, I pray that God will capture your imagination and that you'll also see that not only are you an individual piece of salt or flame of light, but in this text, there's a hint that when we come together, we are a city of light. We are a community of light. That our light blazes stronger when we are with one another, when we are supporting and encouraging one another, when we are building one another up and being clear about God's purposes and plans in our lives. This idea of salt, first of all, in Matthew chapter 9, verses 49 to 50, Jesus says something recorded there, which is very strong, for everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its saltiness, how can you season it? Have salt, he says, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. What's that mean? Later in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, writing to the church in Colossae, says this in chapter 4, verse 6. Conduct yourselves wisely towards outsiders, making the most of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with, so that you may know how you ought to answer everyone. So salt is not a new metaphor only found in Matthew chapter 5. Salt and light are biblical pictures to help us understand how we are to live. Let's take verses 13 and 14 of Matthew 5 together, and then we'll look at verses 15 and 16 together. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, first of all, there are two pictures used for the context of salt and light here. You are the salt of the earth. That's not just the physical planet, although I suggest that it might also include that, contrary to the way many commentators understand the text. We are given the role of custodians of planet Earth. The word that is used in Greek here is the word from which we get geography or geology. It fundamentally refers to the earth. And here, it is being used in the sense of you are salt in your contexts, in your places, in your everyday spots. In verse 14, Jesus doesn't say, you are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the earth. He says, you are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world. The Greek word that is used there is cosmos. It's often translated as system of things. Now, there isn't as big a definition difference between these two words as you might think. Some commentators make it much bigger. It's not as big as many think. The fundamental point being made in both is the same. You are salt where you are placed. You are light in the relationships that you find yourself in the structures and the systems and the society that you are part of. Straight away you see something, don't you? Jesus is not talking about privatized, pietistic salt and light. He is not saying, you are the salt and the world doesn't need to see you, or you're only salt when you are shining in, or living in church, or you're only light when you are worshiping in church. No, he says something very different. The place where we are called to be salt and light is in our, is amongst people, is in community, is amongst our societies, wherever they may be around the world. I would suggest that it is also how we handle the planet and look after the created order around us. But look for a moment down to verse 16, which we will return to more fully in a moment or two. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. There's an invitation to let our light shine into the world around us. Now, Paul says something similar in Philippians chapter 2, verse 16, when he says to the people in Philippi, you are to shine like stars in a crooked universe. And he's borrowing that language from the prophet Daniel, who said that to the people of God when they were in exile. They were far from home. They were far from Jerusalem. They were in a place called Babylon that would become led by the Medes and the Persians. And in that distant context, we know from the Psalms that they began to lose their identity. Because one of the Psalms says this about the people of Israel in the place where all of their familiarity had been stripped away. By the rivers of Babylon, Boney M. didn't write that, by the way, we sat down and there we wept as we remembered Zion. We hung our lyres, our harps upon the trees. For how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? When the people of God feel displaced from the presence of God, they begin to lose their identity. But what Daniel teaches us is even when we are in a society that is against God, even when we live in a culture that doesn't want the name of God mentioned, God is with us. God is right beside us. Daniel teaches the same thing. The people of Israel took their identity from the wrong thing. They needed to take their identity from the promise of God who would never leave them and never forsake them and live out of that reality. That is why, my dear brother and sister, it's easy for you to be a Christian in church and harder to be a Christian in your workplace. Because your workplace is a harder place to be a follower of Jesus. But unless we dismantle the theology that God is only with you on a Sunday and replace it with the truth that God is with you on a Monday, it's going to continue to be harder in the workplace. But where you live, where you work, where you do recreation, these are all also deeply important places for you to shine, for you to be salt. And God has promised that he is with you there just as much as he is with you here. I don't feel it, Malcolm. Well, that doesn't matter. Live out of what you believe, not out of what you feel. Can I let you into a secret? And my workplace is church. I don't get up every day and think, I'm really looking forward to going to work. Some of you want me sacked. No, it's not going to happen. All of us has days when we think, it's going to be harder today. Give me grace, Lord. And God always greets you with the same response. I'm right with you. That's why the promise of Jesus in this passage becomes even more important. He says, he doesn't say, go and be salt, go and be light. He says, you are salt and you are light. Why are we salt and light? Because he is the light of the world and he lives in us. Thomas Aquinas was the first Christian leader to take this metaphor of salt and begin to think about it in a way that has been passed down to us. And he identified three fundamental ideas behind it. One is, and you will be familiar with this, so I'm not going to take long, salt is flavoring. I have a penchant for salt. I don't take as much of it as I used to because it's bad for you if you take too much of the old sodium chloride. But it does make things taste different, doesn't it? I know the difference between a piece of chicken with no salt and a piece of chicken with salt. Without turning this into a sermon, the chicken that I ate 20 years ago tastes different to the chicken that I eat now. That's another story. But salt makes things taste different. It also, as you will know very well, preserves. In Leviticus chapter 2, verse 13, and Leviticus chapter 18, verse 19, there are indications of its power to preserve. But thirdly, and this is often overlooked, in the Old Testament, there is a covenant of salt. There is a relationship with salt around healing, around God's preservative and restorative power present in the salt. There are some passages in the Old Testament that help us understand that. Why don't you turn to a few of them with me just for a moment? 2 Kings 2, 20 to 22. Elisha is performing a miracle, and here's what he says: bring me a new bowl, and put salt in it. So they brought it to him. Then he went to the spring of water and threw the salt into it and said, thus says the Lord, I have made this water wholesome. From now on, neither death nor miscarriage shall flow from it. So the water has been wholesome to this day, according to the word of the Lord. Now go to 2 Chronicles chapter 13. Verse 5. Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt? Now go to Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 4. This is God challenging Israel about their faithlessness. And he says, as for your birth, on the day you were born, your navel cord was cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in clothes. So you see, this salt metaphor in the Old Testament and in Jewish culture is associated with more than just flavoring and preservative. It is associated with covenant. It is associated with cleansing. It is associated with healing. The waters were healed. It is associated with restoration. Jesus says salt is useless if it loses its saltiness. The context is that the salt that would have been used within the context of his day could have lost its chemical power and left behind a residue that looks like salt, but isn't any more salt. It's not doing anything. And it is therefore useless. The phrase that says it has lost its taste in Matthew chapter 5 actually is the Greek word moreno, and it means literally, it has become foolish. One of the commentators on Matthew's gospel says it has become tasteless. The word means inert, pointless, useless, ridiculous. It's making a fool of itself. Is the church making a fool of itself? When we claim to be Christians, but live differently, you see what we're doing? We have become a parody of what we were called to be. And it's not just that we have no power, we are making fools of ourselves. And we are making fools of God's claims upon us. I was thinking about this quite a lot. And this idea of its tastelessness, I was trying to figure out, I don't understand why that word would be used here. And then it clicked for me. Have you ever been in a situation where somebody has done something which was really crass or crude or inappropriate? Or they've done something completely out of character from the moment. They've missed the point completely of a conversation. Or they've said something that is really offensive or difficult or daft. And you might say, what a tasteless thing to do. What a tasteless thing to say in English. You mean they just made a fool of themselves. Jesus is calling us not to make fools of ourselves. And he is saying, when salt loses its saltiness, you're making a fool of yourself. And you're making a fool of my claims upon your life. Now let's think about light for a moment. Back in Matthew chapter 4, verse 16, Jesus has already used this phrase, or Matthew has used it about Jesus. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region in the shadow of death, light has dawned. Matthew isn't bringing us to the idea of being light on our own. We are not light in and of ourselves. The light doesn't begin with us. It begins with Jesus. He is the light. In John chapter 1, we read this in verse 4. In him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness didn't overcome it. And as if to emphasize the point, John then talks about his cousin, Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, as his forerunner. And listen to what he says in verses 8 and 9 about the ministry of John the Baptist. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world. Later in John's gospel, Jesus is recorded as saying in John chapter 8, verse 12, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. You see what's happening? Jesus is the light that all of the Old Testament points to. And Jesus is the light that we point back to. He is the source. When Paul writes to the Corinthians, he says in 2 Corinthians 4, 6, for it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Listen to what Peter says, I think probably reflecting on some of what Jesus says about us being light. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 to 10, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of and into his marvelous. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. When Isaiah was challenging the people of Israel about true fasting and prayer and living in obedience to God's purposes and commands, in chapter 58, here's what he says from verses 8 to 10. When you live the way you were born to live, when you live the way I called you to live, here's the result. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help and he will say, here I am. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the noonday. Salt and light, not just shining into the church, shining into our society, shining into our world, shining into our workplaces. where we live. Yesterday, I had the privilege of praying with a couple of people from our church who are building a new house. And I went to see where it is, and it's a light on a hill. Where we live, where we work, where we do life, that's where we shine. God has not made an accident placing each of us where he has placed us. Thinking about Isaiah for just a moment before we move on, because I think Isaiah is heavy on Matthew's mind as he is recording Jesus. This motif of light is right across it. But Isaiah is talking, of course, to Israel. In 42 verse 6, he says, I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I have taken you by the hand and kept you. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations. This idea keeps coming. 49, 6. I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. What's our vision? What's our vision? Oh gosh, that's enthusiastically responded to. What has God called us to do and be? London and the world for Christ, a light to the nations. Isaiah chapter 60, verse 1, arise, shine, for your light has come and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth and thick darkness the peoples, but the Lord will arise upon you and his glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them the light has shined. It's a powerful image, don't you think? But don't think that we are independent light. You see, behind Isaiah 42, behind Isaiah 49, behind Isaiah chapter 9, behind Isaiah chapter 58, behind Isaiah chapter 60, it is the Messiah's light that shines through his people. Behind you are the light of the world in Matthew, as I am the light of the world in John. I have to let him shine through me. That's what Jesus means when he says, you are the light of the world in verse 14. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. Let me read a really powerful comment that I picked up from one of the scholars that I was considering for today. The hilltop of verse 14 is a symbol not of a conspicuous individual, a superstar, but of the collective impact of a whole community. Modern Western individualism is such that we easily think of the light of the world as a variety of little candles burning, you in your small corner and I in mine. But it is the collective light of a whole community which draws the attention of the watching world. In other words, there are two ways in which our light shines. One is in our lives, and one is when we are together. You know, when you go to work tomorrow, do you think you're going to work on your own? Here's what I'd love us to end up believing. When you go to work, 7,000 KT people are going to work with you. Praying behind you, holding up your arms, celebrating you. When you go to lead that company, when you go to be a headmaster, when you go to work in Tesco's, when you go to pick up somebody that you're caring for, whether you're retired, employed, or unemployed, you are not on your own. We are in this together. And when we gather here and in 37 congregations across London and in dozens more around the world, we shine together for the love and for the glory of Jesus Christ. Amen? Here's the question. Is Jesus asking us to be something or to live out of something? Is being light and salt about identity or is it about calling or is it about both? Why doesn't Jesus say, you must show yourself to be the light? He doesn't say that. He says, you are the salt, you are the light. The Beatitudes, which we explored in the late spring and early summer, demonstrate the life and the character of God in us. Over the rest of this term, we will be exploring what it looks like to be salt and light through the images that Jesus gives us in sexual conduct, in words, in relationships, in vows and promises, six different areas He picks up from Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 through to Matthew chapter 5, verse 48. Reminding us that being light and being salt looks like something, but it's not something we create, it's something we flow out of. One commentator says, followers are sent to help the world to flourish. And Matthew's Sermon on the Mount helps us to understand it. Another says that this is a call to join in the ministry of Jesus as if his presence continues through us. Who we are and what we are called to be is explained in the purpose of our lives in verses 15 and 16. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Now, in brief, this picture is of somebody who lights a light, then hides it under a very big bucket or a very big basket so nobody can see it. It doesn't make sense. There are similar words used in Mark 4, verse 21, and Luke 11, 33, I beg your pardon. But here, this call to let our light shine is not fundamentally about you trying harder. This is where we're going to finish. I don't want you to leave today thinking that salt and light is about you trying harder and doing more and getting onto the treadmill of religious performance and going faster and faster and faster. You're going to get exhausted. The Sermon on the Mount isn't about moral self-improvement. The Sermon on the Mount is an invitation to a surrendered life, in which the Holy Spirit fills us. We'll get to it probably in about 2031. When Jesus says, ask and it will be given, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. Don't think that this series is about me battering you over the head as a theologian or a pastor saying, do more and try harder. No, no, no. This is about you realizing, this is who I am in Christ. This is who Christ is in me. As I surrender my will and my desires, as I get out of the way and let him shine through me, here's what happens. My words improve. My sexual purity improves. My relationships improve. My trust improves. My integrity improves. My character is transformed. I learn how to pray. I learn how to give. I learn how to fast. I learn how not to judge other people. I learn how to trust people. I walk in authenticity. When storms come, they don't knock me over. When I have to choose between the easy and the right path, I'm given the grace to choose the right path. And I'm able to make assessments of myself and others. Who doesn't want a life like that? The Sermon on the Mount is an invitation into this. It is a distinctive lifestyle that flows out of an inherent connection. Now, here's the last thing I want to say. Do you notice the aim of all of this? As salt and light live so that people may celebrate you. No. In fact, later in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew 6, verse 1, Jesus will say, do not perform your religious acts in front of people so that they will praise you. Well, which is it, Jesus? Let your light so shine before men, or do not perform your religious acts in front of people? Which is it? It's all about heart. If you are performing your religious acts before people so that they look at you and say, bravo, you're amazing. You are the answer to the universe. If everybody was like you, the world would be a better place. It's the wrong motivation. What he's questioning is motivation. What he's saying is live publicly in such a way that people will glorify whom? Your Father in heaven, not just God. Let me let you into a secret. There are two ideas about who Jesus is. Well, several others, but two that I want to highlight now for you in this sermon. One is Jesus is King, to whom we give our loyalty and our respect and our obeisance. We follow him, we obey him. Powerful and exciting, right? I'm a citizen of the King. I'm a child of the King. But the other, contained right in the Sermon on the Mount, used far more than king. King isn't used. Well, it's used toward the end of Matthew, but not in this passage. King, that's who God is, King Jesus. Father, You see what happens when you combine these two ideas? He is my king and he is my father. That brings intimacy. That brings identity. That brings inspiration. That brings empowerment. When we serve our king, we are also serving our father. And this idea of fatherhood is right in the middle of this. Glory, so let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and glorify. Not glorify KT. Not glorify Malcolm Duncan. Not glorify Elam. Not glorify the Pentecostal church. Glorify your Father in heaven. What would it look like for us to be ablaze with the light of God's glory and people saying, tell us about your Father. Tell us about your King, because the way you live is the way I want to live. The way you handle things is the way I want to handle things. That's the invitation here. And as we draw our service to a close, again, I told you I couldn't have chosen these texts better. There is one very simple thing. This is not the only thing that you can do out of this message this morning. When you get the notes, read them through. If you're not in a cell, get into a cell. Allow yourself to be discipled and encouraged. You can sign up at reception. You can email us through our website. Get into a small group that can help you to live as a disciple of Jesus and grapple with some of these questions. But next, as you can come forward, next Friday, the 11th of September, in the Houses of Parliament, there is another reading for an assisted dying bill, a new assisted dying bill. Now, I think it's quite clear from the teaching of the Bible and from the instructions of God around how we handle life that allowing people to take their own life is something that we should stand against, and allowing other people to help people take their own life is a difficult and dangerous thing. The legislation as it stands puts a real threat and a real danger upon disabled people. It puts a real danger upon people who feel as if they're going to be under pressure. Just recently in Canada, where laws like this were passed some years ago, a case has come to the front where the doctors in a care home repeatedly asked a person whether they wanted to end their own life. They said no. Their family said no. The family went away for a weekend. The person was unconscious and they took their lives. And they claimed that they had the right to do so. Now, I'm not saying that is the threat here, but I'm saying that there are dangerous and significant threats. Last time this came through the House of Commons, it went through by 12. Now, our Prime Minister, our new Prime Minister, has said that he doesn't support this bill. He wants palliative care and other things to be looked at more effectively before it's discussed again. That's not as far as I would like him to go. I would like him to say I'm against assisted dying. He hasn't gone that far, but I welcome that he has moved. It only takes 12 MPs to vote in a different way, and this will go away for a good number of years, and I want you to help. So behind me, there is a QR code. Take out your phones. Now, I'm not forcing you to do this, but if you believe that you should or you can, and it's not against your conscience, then go to the QR code and send the letter that is there to your MP. I tell you, because I work with MPs a lot in advocacy, this has a huge impact. When members of Parliament see emails coming in saying, we want you to know we're against this, and we are your constituents, if you go to that QR code, you can find out who your MP is, and then you can send an email directly to them saying, please, on Friday, vote against this bill. We also have a number of postcards that are the same thing and they're available, but we've only got 50 of them. I don't know what that says about the faith or the expectation of the campaign, or maybe they just ran out of postcards. But they sent us 50, and I said, go back to them and tell them we'll need 1,000. But 1,000 of us could do this. Will you do it today? Because this debate is on the 11th of September. This is a simple way that you can be salt and light. Don't go against your conscience. But if you live in a constituency in the United Kingdom, online and here, and you can help, please do it. Take the postcards on the way out. If you want to send the postcard, all you need to do is find out the name of your MP, put it on the back, and send it. Although I found out this week, do you know how much a second-class stamp is now in the United Kingdom? 91 pence. The last time I bought a second class stamp, it was about 42p. I couldn't believe it. 91p. Go by email. But would you please get involved if you can?